Want to ask you about the story that you share in your book. It was a book signing in Omaha. Guy Spier was on your side, and there were more things happening that evening. I believe it was an evening, and I don't want to give too much away, but can you tell that story? I really like that story from your book.
Well, it was a momentous day in my life, and I remember I'd basically gone numb and speechless after that event. So what had happened was I'd sold my first book, the self-published version of The Joys of Compounding, for zero royalty, and I'd spent a good sum of money on, publishing the book and hiring the editor and getting all the logistics in place. But I thought, I've learned so much from the value investing community, let me give back to them by not charging any royalty from my first book. And to my surprise, the first book sold very well. And during this book signing in Omaha in May 2019, alongside Guy Spier, Miles Thompson from Columbia Business School Publishing, New York, basically flew over from New York to Omaha to meet me and offer me a publishing opportunity with Columbia. And it was like a dream come true for me, because for many of us value investors, we always have a quiet dream of working on a book with Columbia someday, because that is where value investing originated. That is where Ben Graham used to teach. So what that experience ingrained in my mind and my belief was that when you help others unconditionally, the
Right.
universe works in such a way so as to come back and reward you multiple times over. This is compounding goodwill in action. So after that, I think the thinking which I've adopted in life is that just be a nice person. Just being a nice person and helpful person will eventually lead to a huge competitive advantage for you 5, 10 years down the line.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest topic of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question, what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, and investment advisor to wealth creators with patient capital and an infinite investment horizon. I work with families and individuals who aspire to grow wealth over a lifetime and generations through disciplined, thoughtful investments in durable, quality businesses while giving money meaning. Join me on this quest to unearth and share the wisdom of the ages. I'll keep it short. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to my website, Bogumil Baranowski, where I read your emails and reply to all, and I even offer Zoom calls to you, my listeners. If you want to follow my essays, go to Substack. If you're curious about my last book, search for Crisis Investing. If you want to keep up with Talking Billions, subscribe, follow, and please share it around. It means the world to me. There's no marketing budget behind the podcast. There's no ad revenue. It's all word of mouth and genuine curiosity, yours, mine, and that of our guests. On to the show. Just a quick reminder, I'm the host of the show, but I also work for a registered investment advisor. This episode is for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. My views are personal and not those of the firm. Any securities mentioned are for illustrative purposes and are not recommendations. Investing involves risks. Please consult a financial advisor. Full disclosure can be found in the notes and at the end of the episode. My guest today is Gautam Bate. He is the managing partner of Stellar Wealth Partners India Fund. He invests in listed Indian equities with a long-term fundamental and value-oriented approach. Gautam is the author of the international bestseller on value investing, The Joys of Compounding. In 2018 and 2019, he was profiled in Morningstar's Learn from the Masters series. This is Gautam's second appearance on Talking Billions. I have to congratulate him on the new book, The Making of a Value Investor, that we're discussing today, but also on having held the top 10 position among the most downloaded Talking Billions episodes in the last 12 months. A remarkable feat. Talking Billions is 100 downloads away from a major milestone, 50,000 downloads. If you're listening this week, you're among the many loyal listeners that helped us get there. Thank you all for listening to all 77 episodes. I really appreciate it. Today, we talk about authenticity and vulnerability and how they can help us grow as investors. Gautam reminds me how it's important to focus on the process and principles rather than outcomes, as the market is probabilistic and unpredictable. My guest discusses the mental and emotional resilience needed when investing through the market ups and downs. We take on the definition of a quality business. Stay tuned until the end when Gautam shares how being wrong is a natural part of investing and offers some advice on embracing uncertainty. It was another lovely conversation with a friend and a fellow value investor, and I trust you'll enjoy it as much as I did. Please help me welcome Gautam Bate. Hi, Gautam. How are you? So nice to see you.
Same here, Bogomil. A pleasure to be here.
So you were a guest on Talking Billions close to a year ago, I think, by now. And then in between, you and I had the chance to meet in Omaha and chat after the Markel's brunch, which was fun. The one bonus of this podcast for me is that I either knew all the guests or I got to see them since they were on the show, many of them. So it's been fun to actually see you in person, talk about investing, and have you back on the show. You have another book that came out that I really liked. And I already mentioned to you that it's a very personal book because you share what you were writing really for yourself throughout, you know, two difficult periods, two crises. And then you decided to share it to the world, which I think is a great gift. So I'm going to jump right in. And I want you to tell the story that you share in the book, how an innocent tweet led to the book. And if you can share more about the title itself.
You rightly mentioned that a tweet was basically the genesis of this book. So on 26th August 2022, a follower of mine on Twitter suggested that why don't I publish my journal entries and learnings from my journal into a book? Because for many years, I'd been posting on LinkedIn and Twitter about the benefits and virtues of maintaining an investment journal. So I found this follower's idea to be very helpful and interesting. And shortly thereafter, I started work on the book, and it took me approximately 12 months to complete writing my second book, The Making of a Value Investor.
And it's just not just any period in time. You were writing those notes in some very difficult times. So the lessons that you took away, they're pretty, you know, personal and vulnerable. How did you feel about sharing all of that? I feel like it's a big, big step, big leap.
Well, one of my investing mentors, Guy Spier, has taught me that the true path to success in life and investing world is through authenticity. Mm-hmm. You have to open yourself up to your audience, share your vulnerabilities and weaknesses, because this helps you gather valuable feedback from your audience, and you use that unfiltered feedback to correct your biases and improve yourself. So I think that's why it was very important to, you know, not just talk about the successes, but the big failures as well. Because at the end of the day, investing is a probabilistic activity. It is never deterministic. It's always shades of gray. It's never black or white. And this is why, you know, you have to share the entire story. And what this book basically brings out is that at the end of the day, all of us investors and fund managers are just human beings at the end of the day. And right, if the market cycle is not in your favor, if the market mm-hmm. is against you, if the sentiment in this market is very negative, mm-hmm. then in spite of your best efforts, you won't be able to make money. In fact, by December 2018, many of these great tech companies in the US, like Google, Facebook, Amazon, and all the large mega cap companies here, all of them had fallen 30-40% for the year. So they were right. great companies then, and they were great companies in 2022 as well. But the same pattern repeated, and then they again fell in such a big way. So just be humble and uh-huh. focus on your process. That is the best uh-huh. you can do as an investor.
The only thing we can actually control is the process, the principles, the philosophy, and the outcomes. They follow, but we can't really focus too much on the outcome, especially a very specific number. There's so many quotes. I want to bring up one quote from your book to start with. You say, by the time the bear market ended, I had evolved from being a highly concentrated portfolio investor focused on statistically cheap securities to one focused on quality and prudent diversification. Tell me more. There's a journey that you went through throughout this process.
An alternative subtitle for this book could be our personal experiences in the market uh-huh. eventually lead us to our individual investing styles. This is True. Basically what this book is all about. So for many years prior to the bear market in India, which started from January 2018, for mm-hmm. many years before that, I primarily invested in deep cyclicals, commodity stocks, micro caps. I used to take very high risk, be very, very concentrated, follow a portfolio of 5 to 6 stocks, and I was very fortunate and lucky that I made a good sum of money using that highly risky method before the bear market in India began in January
Right.
2018. But this long bear market, which lasted from 1st January 2018 to 23rd March 2020, over those 27 months, this experience ingrained in my mind the significance of resilience and longevity, the key to compounding. And by the time the bear market ended, I'd evolved from being a highly concentrated investor who used to focus on statistically cheap securities to one focused on quality and prudent diversification. Capital preservation would take precedence for me henceforth. And by the time the bear market ended, I started focusing on return of capital, therefore return on capital. So that was, so quality, quality, quality. This would become the mantra for long-term success for me going forward after that bear market ended. I learned one more big lesson for the remainder of my investing career, Bogumil, that however well you may have prepared and may have calculated your odds, risk surfaces from places you can never imagine.
Right.
Even if you're very careful in crossing the road by looking left and right, a drone might still kill you from above. Things can go wrong in ways you can never think of, and your only defense against an unknown future is prudent diversification. A portfolio of stocks diversified across risk factors and industries hold between 20 to 25 holdings, and this particular practice ensures against a catastrophic outcome for the portfolio as a whole, and it also opens the door for you to optionality. So this is the philosophy which I've developed after that bear market, and this is the very philosophy which I follow for Stellar Wealth Partners India Fund and for my other PMS clients in India.
It's the focus on survival. You don't want to have an outcome that could really derail you. And a lot of humility that realizing that no matter how well you research the stock and how sure you feel about the investment, they can still surprise you. And speaking of that, there's another quote that I really like. You said, during a bear market, even if you buy good stocks cheap, you need to be mentally prepared for further drawdowns. And the whole idea of, living in a drawdown, that I want to ask after that. But tell me more. You're buying a good stock and it's still gonna fall, and you have to be ready for it. That's a very hard ask.
I will give a actual case study here. Let me give a case study from the US markets. In 2022, Meta was a great business. Even today, it is a great business. But in 2022, the stock of Meta fell 60%, 60. So if you
Right.
bought after the first 10% fall, after that, it fell another 50%. So you kept on buying on every 10% dip, and there was no bottom in sight, right? But from the bottom of the stock in October 2022, the stock of Meta has risen 450% over the next 15 months. So the intrinsic value of the business did not change by 450% in 15 months, but the stock fell 60%, even though it was a great business in 2022. So even if you buy a great quality business at a reasonable price in a bear market, you have to be mentally prepared for further drawdowns because volume is always higher. The quantity of sellers is always higher on the way down. That is when you can build a large position and buy a large chunk, a good quantity, without any impact cost. In a rising market, in a bull market, you end up incurring big impact cost on the entry because there are hardly any people wanting to sell the stock in question. So bear markets are when you can actually build up, good size allocations in high quality businesses because there is much more supply and less demand for those stocks.
How do you mentally and emotionally deal with a drawdown? And just for the context, somebody had this interesting quote the other day, how unless you're very lucky and you buy a stock that doesn't go down anymore from the point when you bought it, you have to be ready that it will go down even more and even more, even more. I actually get excited about it because I get to buy more of whatever I like, but it's a peculiar and I think acquired preference. But for a lot of people, they have this number locked in. I bought it at 20 and it's at 17 and it's at 14. It's painful on so many levels to watch your stocks remain in that negative territory before they do follow, hopefully, that rise back and maybe even higher than they used to be. How do you mentally deal with that time?
The way to develop that mental fortitude to handle stock price volatility on the downside is to be an ardent student of financial market history. So I've got this print out on my desk of, drawdowns in the Indian market, intra-year drawdowns for the last 30 years, and also of many high-quality stocks in India, their price patterns, price behavior over the last 30 years. All the big multi-baggers in the US and Indian market have had periods of sharp drawdowns, but eventually quality rises back to all-time highs. But junk quality bad stocks take a long time to recover, if at all. So if you understand how these, if you are a student of history, and if you know that quality eventually rises back and bounces back to all-time highs after
Right.
every bear market, that is what will help you develop the calm mind and the equanimity to handle such deep drawdowns. Otherwise, and unless you have a deep understanding of the business, you'll panic at the first sign of trouble, at the first 20% fall, and you'll end up selling near the bottom. So, be a business analyst like Munger has taught us, not a securities analyst. Securities analysts focus on stock prices,
Right.
whereas, value investors are business analysts who focus on the underlying business. If you can understand, how the business is performing, how the prospects of the business look like, then you can be very comfortable in holding on. But the work is required. Many people want to skip that initial research work, that initial work of studying the business, and just chase momentum at any price.
So the markets, what I'm hearing, teach us lessons. And these are expensive lessons. It's almost like going back to school. You just don't know what the tuition will be sometimes. But you have the second part of the title of the book when you talk about what the bear market taught you. And I feel like if you're going to learn something, I think the bear markets are an incredible, costly place to learn. Can you talk about, in big picture, big bullet points, ideas, what did the bear market teach you out of all of it?
Bogomil, this book is dedicated to all my investor friends and colleagues, without whose useful feedback and guidance and constant moral support, I would have never been able to survive that difficult bear market in India in 2018 and 19. And many of my seniors shared very valuable pieces of wisdom with me during that period, and I would like to share, some of those pieces of wisdom with you and your audience right now as well. The first piece of advice they gave me was that if you want to make it big as an investor in the stock market, you need to be detached, mentally detached from stock price fluctuations, because during bear markets, it becomes extremely difficult to endure such severe notional losses. That is the first thing. Be emotionally detached from stock price fluctuations on the downside. The second big point which they told me was that India will grow at a healthy rate. The primary indices, the Nifty and the Sensex, the large cap indices, their earnings will grow at low double digits, but at any point of time, there will be a few mid-cap and small-cap stocks which are poised to grow their earnings per share at 25 to 30% CAGR over the next 4 to 5 years, and they are bound to create wealth for you in the long run. All that you need is the patience and conviction to back them. In the long run, all that counts is earnings, earnings, and earnings, like Peter Lynch has taught us. The third piece of advice, and very important, which they explained to me, was sanity will eventually prevail, just like it has always has after every bear market. After the dust settles, sanity always prevails, and then you have a start of a new bull market. The fourth and very important piece of advice which they shared with me was, believe in India, its business ecosystem, and the power of its entrepreneurs, because this will what will help you stay the course across market cycles through all the ups and downs. In the long run, that's how you create wealth, by time in the market, not by timing the market.
I like that. You brought up market cap sizes, and I was very intrigued by that point in a couple of the notes that you had in your journal. And the reason I bring it up because you noticed it in India a few years back. That's what's in your book. And obviously, more recently in the US market, we see a disconnect between how the small caps and the large caps are performing, and it happens now and then. I'm curious, can you talk about that? What you've learned watching both markets, the Indian market and the US market? What happens when the two different groups of market caps, the large companies and the small companies, don't really perform the same way?
Yep. So basically, during a bear market, the reason why people fly to safety of large cap stocks is that on a relative basis, the drawdowns are lesser than that experienced in the small cap space. In a bear market, small caps get basically decimated. But large caps also, while they fall less to a lesser extent. And this is the common point between both the US and the Indian markets, that during a bear market, small caps will out underperform the large caps, but in a raging bull market, generally mid cap and small caps tend to outperform, especially in the Indian market. In the US market right now, I've never quite seen anything like this, that you on paper you have a bull market going on, but it is restricted to the super six. I don't even call them the Magnificent Seven. I'll take out Tesla from that list. It's all about the super six. And if you are not in Nvidia and Meta and a few other of the super six, then you will grossly underperform the Nasdaq 100 and the S&P 500. So active investing in the US, was very difficult last year. That's why, in spite of last year, the S&P 500 and Nasdaq notching up good gains, most hedge funds badly underperformed the benchmark because many of them thought that these are trillion-dollar companies. How much higher can they go? But these tech companies are simply redefining the game for investors around the world. I mean, it's way beyond imagination what's happening here.
It's fascinating on so many levels. I remember a long time ago when there was a discussion about Apple in some of the meetings that I was in, and somebody told me, "There are no trillion-dollar companies, don't you know?" And I was thinking, that's such an interesting statement, because I would add and say, "Yet," right? At that point, we didn't have one yet. But the same way U.S. Steel, 100-some years ago, was the first billion-dollar company, we were bound to have trillion-dollar companies, right? That was bound to happen. But they have such a disproportionate weight in the benchmarks that they really decide in which direction the benchmark will go. And by definition, they attract even more attention because they're going up. It's the momentum that you brought up earlier, an interesting phenomenon. But those things you said, sanity always comes back. I feel like at the end of the day, somehow those things average out and turn around in whichever direction. Either the small caps will catch up, or the large caps drop, or they meet halfway. But the disconnect at the end of the day cannot go on forever. If you have a dollar earned at a small company or a dollar earned at a big company, it's still a dollar earned. And there's no reason to have a huge disconnect between the two different worlds. We just touched on momentum. And I want to dive in a little bit more because you have some points in the book about quality and momentum investing. Can you explain for the benefit of the audience how you see them differently and what they mean? Or maybe in some ways they are the same sometimes, but not necessarily.
Momentum investing basically means chasing stocks at any price, irrespective of their valuations or business fundamentals. Those are basically for technical analysts who are looking at price volume action and different chart patterns to invest or trade in stocks. Whereas quality investing basically takes into account not only the quality of the business and the management, but also the price being paid, because quality at any price does not work. You need three things for a long-term investment to work. You need quality, you need growth, and you need a reasonable price. Even an expensive price is fine. For if you pay an expensive entry price, the longevity of growth will be so long that you'll eventually end up making good returns. You'll basically have to sacrifice the first year return. The returns from year 2 to year 5 will compensate you for the lack of returns in year 1. But everything has got a price, and sensible prices are very, very important for you to make money as an investor.
So the interesting thing is that when there are moments when quality becomes something trendy, and I think the word quality has been brought up in so many conversations that I've been a part of, not just the podcast, but in person events, and the quality seems everybody has quality as their objective. So it gets so far that it becomes the theme of the day, you know? And I wonder, do we get the definition right? Is it the same definition for all the people? And I think for some people, quality means a stock they can own and it will always rise, which is always a dangerous proposition. But there's more to quality. Can you talk about how you look at quality? How do you know that you're dealing with a quality stock or quality business, even without the stock price?
So there are three characteristics of any quality business in the true sense. First, it has to have a return on capital which is much above its cost of capital, because any business which is earning less than cost of capital will destroy value. The second point which has to be there is the business has to have some moat or competitive advantage which allows it to earn that high return on capital for a long period of time. And third and most important, the business has to have reinvestment opportunities within itself at high returns on invested capital. That kind of business becomes a compounding machine. So if all these three things are present, high ROCE, and then a competitive advantage along with reinvestment opportunities at high ROIC, you get a high quality business and a compounding machine. And here I would like to also add, just to address the first part of your question, Benjamin Graham, has talked about this aspect of, people herding into one particular investment style. And what Graham told us was, you can get into far bigger trouble with a good idea rather than a bad idea, because you tend to forget that the good idea has got limits. So
Right.
when different sectors and themes, catch the fancy of investors in the market, for example, artificial intelligence, it may be revolutionary, but in the absence of, any significant entry barriers, what will happen is, as per the capital cycle theory, as more capital starts entering a particular field, the return on invested capital starts going down. So Sam Altman of OpenAI, recently I was reading the news that he's looking for $7 trillion of funding for AI chips. Imagine the amount of supply that's about to hit the market in AI. So basically, over time, even though you may get growth, but it may not be very high profitable growth. Nvidia may be an exception, but I think for many companies, you need to be careful not to get carried away by the mania and pay attention to their balance sheet, working capital and cash flow, and their competitive advantage position. These things, you should not lose sight of these important parameters, especially during a sectoral bull market, because this is when we tend to let down our guard and we end up with permanent loss of capital in the subsequent bear market. This is basically what my second book talks about in detail, that so many sins and mistakes were made by investors, including me, in the 2014 to 2017 mid-cap and small-cap bull market in India. Because when stock prices are going up so rapidly, you start thinking of yourself very highly that, okay, I'm a very astute, smart investor. But like what Buffett has taught us, it is only when the tide goes out that you realize who has been swimming naked. So make sure that you're not that person.
You're touching on something fascinating. When I look at businesses, I see them as profit pools or profit streams. And I'm intrigued how they do it, but at the end of the day, I want to see that they are able to produce cash flows. And with innovation, it gets a bit tricky because in many cases, we don't know just yet what the business models will be like. 25 years ago, people were excited about the internet. And it was dial up and slow. And I would just watch the video how somebody was sending an email some years ago, what it looked like. So we got really excited a quarter of a century ago about something that did change our life in the following 25 years, but in many different ways than we thought. And internet and you and I, and even talking right now and recording, it's all thanks to the internet. But the profit pools that were created in this new industry were not exactly where I think people initially thought. It's very tricky because we get excited about AI and different ideas, but we don't know yet how this new idea will create actual businesses where unit economics work, where the capital investment is at a decent rate, and when you actually get the cash back. It's very, very tricky. Innovation is a very tricky place, especially for anybody that has a bit of a value investor bias in it. Do you have some thoughts about it? How do we not get in trouble?
Well said. In fact, because of the high uncertainty of the future payoff, any investor, or including a venture capitalist, follow the principle of diversification. So they spread their bets across different innovative bets, because just like a macro cap or small cap investor, because the probability of failure is very high and the chances of success are low, but when the success does happen, it's an exponential payoff. Therefore, any portfolio investor who focuses on innovative ideas in tech or in small cap or micro cap stocks, either of these two strategies, that particular investor has to definitely follow a diversified approach. That is basically the way you deal with this. And this is why I talked about opening the door to optionality. Because, if you, for example, if you made a basket of different tech and non-tech businesses, and one of them, a few of them were, Meta and Nvidia, or a few of these tech companies, then, you would have basically made a good return at an aggregate portfolio level. So the key here is to let your winners run. So even in my India fund portfolio, since inception in October 2022, even though the returns have been very good so far, since cumulatively, but when I did a portfolio attribution analysis, I got to know that just 20 to 25% of the stocks, one fourth of the portfolio has delivered almost 100% of the overall return. The rest 75% basically just cancel themselves out. So the key is to let your winners run. Don't disturb your winners. This is basically how you make a successful investment career.
So there are two big points that I really like. One is the holding period. When you said winners run, I wrote down holding period. So you made a point about diversifying. I think every investor eventually learns that there's a certain number of holdings that we feel comfortable with. I know people that hold 4 stocks, and I know people that hold 100. So everybody has to find a place where they feel comfortable, quality of sleep, your own and your client's quality of sleep. I think that's key. The winners run and the few stocks that take all the credit, it's really fascinating. It's the classic 80-20 rule where you have just a handful of stocks. Now, not only that, but I think the journey, I'm thinking of Chris Mayer and the 100X companies, just as an example. Phelps wrote about it before, that if you are looking at a winner like this, if you look at a 25-year chart, let's say, of a company that really went 100X, it wasn't an easy journey. So I think it's very, very hard, and we spoke about it briefly before, the emotional journey. If you have massive drawdowns on the way up, and even Buffett said, look at Berkshire, I think it was down 3 or 4 times, 50% in the last 40, 50 years, right? So if you want to hold something that will go up 20 times, 50 times, 100 times, you have to be ready to watch it drop on the way up 50% or more, 50% or more, 50% or more. I think that's the hardest part. Not even picking it, but actually holding it through it. Do you have some thoughts?
The ability to hold requires a much higher level of qualitative insight mm-hmm. than the ability to buy. And there are basically two things which drive this ability to hold. After you have purchased a high quality business, mm-hmm. the reinvestment potential at high ROIC and potential of double digit revenue growth for a long period of time. So basically, this is what helps drive long-term value creation. And understanding the bond between the customer and the company mm-hmm. is what will help you develop the conviction to hold. Because without customers being present, if the customers leave the brand or the product or the service, mm-hmm. then there is no valuation which can provide you a margin of safety. Margin of safety mm-hmm. comes from the customers loving the product or the service and perpetually choosing it over all other alternatives. So as a long-term investor in a business, a good understanding of the product or the service and mm-hmm. consumer behavioral or customer behavior is critical. Now, if you look at most stock market investors, they basically focus on everything else. So basically this softer aspect, this qualitative aspects is very, very important. Otherwise, you will not be able to hold the business mm-hmm. through all these severe drawdowns. In fact, the challenge here, Bogomil, I'll be honest with you, the challenge here is that when a business falls 30-40%,
right,
it usually is accompanied by very bad news about some gross capital misallocation by the company. Right. Let's give an example here, like Meta, for example. In mm-hmm. 2022, when they were investing tens of billions of dollars on this metaverse pet project of Mark Zuckerberg, everyone rightfully criticized the business and the stock was rightfully punished. Because at the end of the day, it is all about the trajectory mm. of the return on capital employed. The trajectory of the ROIC is what drives valuation de-rating or re-rating in a business. So investors were right in punishing the stock in 2022. So just imagine you have been invested in Meta for 10 years, suppose mm. up to that point, and then suddenly you face a 50% drawdown because of this sudden big, huge capital misallocation. What do you do? This is why holding on to these businesses over the long run, it's very, very difficult in reality. We often talk about this stock which become a 100 bagger or a 10 bagger mm-hmm. or a 20 bagger. But holding on during those interim periods of such doubt and uncertainty is not easy. It's very, very difficult.
I wrote a piece about a stock for a grandchild, and then I extrapolated it into an idea of, let's say 20 stocks for 20 years. And the idea was when I asked people, well, what stock would you buy for 20 years? I don't know why, but the initial response is they give me very established brands that will likely be around in 20 years. And I say, that's not what I'm really asking. I'm asking for a company that's worth waiting for. I know that Coca-Cola and then all those brands probably will be around in 20 years. But I don't know if they're worth the wait, at least from this point in time. I'm not sure. I'm open to discussion about that. But there are certain businesses that I won't mention, but I can think of that I think will use those 20 years to truly impress me. They deserve the wait. And it's an interesting exercise. A couple of things happen. One, you kind of relax about the near-term performance, the ups and downs and the cycles and everything else. And you're thinking about 20 years from now, will this business be bigger, better, or not? Do you have some thoughts about it? Just to throw the rock really, really far away and see where it could fall and make that wait really worth it.
My second book, if you noticed, I've made a very controversial to some, but I made this statement that the days when you could take a 5 to 7 year view on a stock are long gone now. In my view, 2 to 3 years is the maximum feasible period in today's highly disruptive and fast-changing environment.
Yeah.
Basically, it's better to latch on to ideas with very good growth visibility for the next 2 to 3 years. And then at the end of the three-year period, if the future growth prospects are looking good for the subsequent 2 to 3 years, then you hold on. And this is how multi-baggers actually happen in reality for investors. No one can ever predict what's going to happen 5, 10, 20 years down the line. Start with a shorter-term time period of 2 to 3 years. That's much more feasible. And then you keep evaluating as you go along the way. So active patience, that is diligently verifying your original investment thesis and doing nothing as long as nothing materially adverse or negative emerges. This is the hallmark of all the great investors. So active patience, keep checking and verifying your original thesis all along the way. But start with a 2 to 3 year view, because that's much more practical and much more possible, I would say, as an investor to do. Because forecasting in today's era of highly disruptive change 10 years out, I think that is very, very difficult, almost impossible in my view now.
I think you make a fascinating point. When I think of a stock that I would buy for 20 years, I know that I would watch it and I know that I would question if it's still relevant. The interesting thing is that if I shrink my investment horizon and I say 3-5 years, I assume that I will leave it after 3-5 years. I think you can combine in some way both the kind of a renewal, that after 3-5 years, you renew it for the next 3-5 years and you renew it for 3-5 years. But I really like to at least imagine, does this business belong in this world 20 years from now? And does it have a way to impress me? While I'll continuously, I agree with you, check, has anything changed dramatically that will not allow this business to succeed? And I think you make a fascinating point, and there are numbers that show it, how companies belong to the top 500 shorter than ever before. They even stay in an index shorter than ever before, and on and on. And I think I think it's less than 10 years that stocks belong to the top 500 or something. So it's a short period of time. I think one study shows that a company on average has glory years, like the best years, for 18 years or so. So it's really interesting that the runways are much shorter than we think. So, and I think if anything with the innovation that you brought up, I think those periods will be shorter. It's very tricky, because when you buy a business, the terminal value is everything that will be created beyond the 3-5 years, right? So even if you buy a stock at, I don't know, $100, the $80 of the value, we assume, the models assume, whichever valuation model you want to use, will be created beyond the 3-5 years. So you do make an assumption about the future. How right are you going to be? I don't know, but you do make an assumption.
Absolutely. Well said. In fact, when I said a horizon of 3 years, obviously, I do think long term that, okay, this business will be in existence 10 years out. That's how you make your DCF, your discounted cash flow model. But basically, start initially with a 2 to 3 year view that, okay, have some working assumptions, more realistic assumptions and practical assumptions for the next 3 years. And then you keep evaluating along the way, because in the Indian markets where I operate, there I've noticed that very few businesses outside of FMCG, that is fast moving consumer goods, in US we call them packaged good companies, but very few businesses are able to actually sustain their high growth phase for a long period of time. Most of them get disrupted along the way, and then the terminal value just falls off a cliff and you end up with permanent loss of capital unless you exit in time. So this is why you really have to be very alert nowadays and really observe your businesses like a hawk. Don't observe the stock price. I'm not really bothered too much by the stock prices. Eventually they do catch up with earnings, but I'm very razor sharp focused on the businesses which I own, because any kind of risk. It can be a regulatory risk or a insider risk, or the in India we call the insiders promoters, or it can be an industry risk. You know, if there are so many risks to manage when you're a fund manager, and this is why, you know, terminal value, you know, investing is so important, that because that is where 70 to 80% of your overall intrinsic value resides. So if something is disrupting the terminal value or enhancing the terminal value, then you will get the benefit of or the disadvantage of re-rating or valuation de-rating. So, you know, observe what's happening in the underlying business.
I like the sound of that. I think, if anything, for an active manager, there are more things to watch and more things to pay attention to, and it's harder to just buy and not look. I think it's very tricky. You brought up something very briefly a few minutes ago that I want to come back to. You talked about the bond with the customer, and then you grew to appreciate it even more so during the crisis. And I think Nick Sleep talks about it. You quoted Nick Sleep in your book. It's such a fascinating idea when you think about a business. You know, we look at the financials, look at the balance sheet, we look at the numbers, but there's something that we really have to pay attention to beyond the management, separate topic. There's a certain bond with the product, with the brand, with the experience that people keep coming back. So even if it's a difficult time, they won't cancel the subscription, they won't renew the product, whatever it is. Can you talk about that? Let's come back to that for a second, because I feel like if you have businesses that have developed something like that, to me, it's one of the pieces of the puzzle. When you talked about quality, they're doing something special.
Correct. And that special thing which you're referring to, that is what in investing parlance we call the moat or the competitive advantage. Because by doing something special in one of the following categories, that is how businesses develop a moat. So the first is brand, like you rightly mentioned. The primary purpose of brands is to lower search costs and to assure a minimum product quality. So, you know, obviously brands also help you charge a premium from your customers, and any business which has got pricing power, which can price its product in line with inflation growth or above inflation growth, that's basically the real pricing power. So brands are one way to develop that bond between the customer and the company. The second way to develop that bond is through switching costs. Sometimes the company's services are so deeply entrenched in the consumer's overall architecture that it's very difficult to switch to another vendor. So Oracle's SAP software, once it's deeply entrenched in the customer's architecture, it's very difficult for the customer to switch to a different vendor, as an example. The third is network effects. So this is very simple. You know, basically, as more buyers and sellers, you know, interact on a particular platform, there's a network effect in place, and you get accelerating fundamental momentum. So, for example, the more people use Uber, the more availability of drivers that there is, and therefore, you know, again, similarly, that drives even more user adoption. So there's a virtuous cycle. Similarly, the more people that are on a particular social network, the more other people want to join that particular social network. So there's a network effect in play. So brand, switching cost, network effects, these are some of the, you know, attributes which have developed that bond. And one more very important aspect which helps develop that bond between the customers and the business is company culture. So this is a very soft aspect, but, you know, we investors are always looking for companies that are, empathizing with their customers much more than their competitors are, because companies with a very good culture, those companies' employees tend to do their daily jobs slightly better than their competitors do. And over time, these small daily advantages compound into something much more bigger and much more larger. And this is, you know, why companies like Geico, Nebraska Furniture Mart, Costco, you know, they have become the epitome of consumer loyalty. So, you know, it's very difficult for consumers to leave these companies and go elsewhere because they have earned the consumer's trust. So trust is a byproduct of a good culture in the company.
It's funny that you said trust, because as you were talking, I wrote down the word trust, because there's something intangible that happens between the customer and the company where you just know you're going to get the same treatment. You show up in a different part of the world, you walk out, and you assume that this brand represents something that in a different country with a different environment, they'll provide you exactly the same experience. And it's something that's not on the balance sheet. We just know it, right? And when you value it, it's very tricky. But you see when a company gets tested during a crisis that people will still go and pay up or spare the extra dollar to go to that particular brand and nobody else. And I think that's that intangible little thing that can really move it and make a business a real success. I had Christian Billinger on the show, and we talked about certain people that will do the right thing even if nobody's watching. You know, the soul in the game, he calls it pride in the game. And it rhymes with some of the things that I was reading in your book, how, you know, experienced investors may have come to the business for the money, but at a certain level, it's not about the money. And I feel like when you look at some founders, maybe they initially thought this will be about money, but they don't show up every day once they have billions because of the money. Can you talk about that, both on the investor side and the management side, when the passion and the love for something drives us forward and the paycheck is kind of a secondary element? You pointed out in your book, and it made me pause. That's why I'm bringing it up.
Very true, Bogomil. In fact, investing, as we all know, is very challenging over a long time period. Mm-hmm. And it is essential to have great enthusiasm for the intellectual process of investing in order to sustain in this field for a long period of time. Because mm-hmm. without the inner strength of our passion for investing to carry us during the periodic phases of pain and suffering, mm-hmm. it is unlikely that we will be able to survive in this field for long. Personally speaking, stock market investing remains the most fascinating analytical sport I've ever come across. Mm-hmm. And it is my lens to understanding the world. Because of investing, I feel more connected to the world around me. And you know, to be a truly passionate investor means that you're always enthusiastically observing everything around you and always thinking about the future and direction of the world. Mm-hmm. And investing isn't just a process of wealth creation, Bogomil. It is a source of great intellectual delight. Sheer intellectual delight and great happiness for the truly passionate investor. And I wouldn't want to live life any other way. I truly love what I do every day, and I feel blessed and fortunate to have discovered my passion and calling in life. As far as business managements go, we call them, there are two kinds of managements, missionaries and uh-huh. mercenaries. Okay, so missionaries are on a mission to basically right. improve the overall well-being of society. And those are the companies, basically, you know, if you can identify them at a small cap or mid cap stage and then stick with them over the long run, you can make some really big wealth, because they end up disrupting multiple industries and capturing market share. Mm-hmm. And this market share capture is a source of great value creation for shareholders over time. So good example, it is Tesla, for example, or even, you know, Facebook in its initial days, or, you know, Apple when they, you know, started launching different products like the iPod, the iPad, the iPhone, etc. Similarly, for all these, you know, companies which are looking to disrupt many other industries, I think they are basically led by missionaries. They are not in it for the money, to be honest. You know, we have all heard of stories of how Elon Musk basically bet it all and almost went bankrupt on his early ventures, but it was his belief mm-hmm. in what he was trying to do that eventually led Tesla to become what it has become today. On the other hand, you have mercenaries. Basically, these are basically management teams with very fat pay packages mm-hmm. and, you know, very high ESOPs, you know, employee stock options. They are trying to maximize the stock price. They are focused more on the stock price and the market cap rather than mm-hmm. the value which they're delivering to their end consumer. So basically, you know, if a business focuses on the well-being of its end customer, there's a saying in the market that, you know, happy customers make for happy shareholders. So basically right. focus on businesses which are making their customers happy with profitable unit economics and sufficient reinvestment opportunities and headroom to grow, mm-hmm. and you have a long-term winner on your hands.
I like the sound of that. Actually paying attention to who are the people that are running businesses and why, and then in the investment world, I think it's really fascinating to see why people do what they do. And I share the same passion that you do. There's nothing else I would rather do. Somebody said to me the other day how investing is a profession where you have to be ready to starve at times and you can't switch to anything else. I'm sure there are other pursuits. I'm thinking of acting. Probably acting is one of those pursuits where you have to keep on showing up until you get a break. And fortunately, in the investment world, we don't all have to be Al Pacinos. We can do just fine. But the passion is what keeps us going, and it tests us. The markets test us. And all those ups and downs are a big test as well. I want to ask you about the story that you share in your book. It was a book signing in Omaha. Guy Spier was on your side. And there were more things happening that evening. I believe it was an evening. And I don't want to give too much away. But can you tell that story? I really like that story from your book.
Well, it was a momentous day in my life, and I remember I'd basically gone numb and speechless after that event. So what had happened was I'd sold my first book, the self-published version of The Joys of Compounding, for zero royalty, and I did not. I'd spent a good sum of money on publishing the book and hiring the editor and getting all the logistics in place. But I thought I've learned so much from the value investing community. Let me give back to them by not charging any royalty from my first book, and. To my surprise, the first book sold very well. And during this book signing in Omaha in May 2019, alongside Guy Spier, Miles Thompson from Columbia Business School Publishing, New York, basically flew over from New York to Omaha to meet me and offered me a publishing opportunity with Columbia. And it was like a dream come true for me because for many of us value investors, we always have a quiet dream of working on a book with Columbia someday because that is where value investing originated. That is where Ben Graham used to teach. So, what that experience ingrained in my mind and my belief was that when you help others unconditionally, the
Right.
universe works in such a way so as to come back and reward you multiple times over. This is compounding goodwill in action. So after that, I think the thinking which I've adopted in life is that just be a nice person. Just being a nice person and helpful person will eventually lead to a huge competitive advantage for you 5, 10 years down the line. Because in our niche value investing community where almost everyone knows everyone else. People with a good reputation of being nice, helpful people, they are the ones, to whom, nice, good, nice, productive discussions are shared
Sure.
with. Those are the people to whom, people reach out to share good stock ideas, good investment opportunities. It's a virtuous cycle, basically, which starts once you develop a good reputation in your circles. So just be a nice and helpful person. I think it will not only help you in your personal life, in your professional life also, over the long run, it will definitely reap very big dividends for you.
And it's such a nicer life to live, don't you think? If you're just nice to other people. And I wrote an article, Return on Kindness, after going to Omaha last year, and I thought,
I remember that. It was a fantastic read. Yeah.
thank you. I came back and I was thinking, how would I summarize this experience? Because it's so many things happened, so many small conversations and big talks and events, and obviously the main event. And I thought, I just received so much kindness from people that I know very well and from people that I don't know at all just yet. And I had an opportunity to share my kindness and my wisdom with people that I just met. And I thought it was just a remarkable moment. And I don't know, I still think about that event and I'm looking forward to this year's. I want to ask you about the other aspect of investing. So you're running an investment firm. A lot of investors end up running an investment firm. All clients knock on your door. And you have this one quote that made me really pause and think from my own experience. I've been in the business 20 years, worked with many clients, and you wrote, choose the best check, not the biggest check. And I think such a simple idea, but sums up so much about the investment experience when you're managing other people's money. Can you talk about that?
This basically refers to client selection, and for Stellar Wealth Partners India Fund, the quality of my investor base matters a lot to me, and that's why I engage in very diligent and thorough client screening at the very beginning. So over the last 2 years, I had to reject many of the clients who reached out to me to invest in my fund because they were asking all the wrong questions. Some of them were asking me, how much can I expect to make from your fund over the next 12 months? One person told me that I plan to fund my, child's college education after 2 years, so how much can I make from your fund in the next 2 years? You have to avoid short-term minded clients because these are the very clients who will panic at the first sign of trouble in a bear market or a market sell-off and cause a lot of headache for you, as a fund manager in turbulent times. The idea is to align yourself with like-minded, long-term minded people and patient investors. And investors who have the right temperament. When I say the right temperament, it is those investors who are willing to put in additional capitals when such a high quality portfolio value falls in a bear market. Because that is the way you should logically be investing. If you have bought a good quality portfolio, then you should add more to it during market falls. When the portfolio value falls 15-20%, that's time to add more to it. But if you get a short-term minded client, if in the because you chased a big amount of money rather than a high quality client, then those clients will cause you a lot of trouble. When the going is good, everything will seem hunky dory and you'll be happy. But they'll give you much more misery and unhappiness during a bear market like 2022, for example. Because that is when they'll start questioning your risk management practice, your investment philosophy, your style of investing. They'll start doubting everything which they had belief on in the first place while the going was good during the bull market. So avoid those kinds of clients when you're managing public money.
It's fascinating that you need the strongest commitment in times of the greatest opportunity, which happen to be also the times that will test you the most. And it's kind of counterintuitive when you look from far away, but that's how the business really works. So the best opportunities will be in times when nobody wants to invest. By definition, the price is low, people get spooked, they run away. And these are the moments when you do want to have the capital to invest. So you need clients that either joined you before or know you at the moment and will commit capital in times where it's very, very uncomfortable to commit. On all the fronts, it's a big, big ask that you are able to deliver, that they are willing to stay with you. And then obviously, that you remain in business in times like this. It's fascinating because when people look at investing, like, I want to find stocks that go up. But then you think about whose money are you managing and why and what's the bigger context. And then you're thinking about the business side. There's a certain framework that you operate in and you provide the service. And all of those have to happily coexist. If they don't, it's trouble. Assets leave, businesses get undermined. And no matter how incredible your results and approach is, if there's no capital to manage, what's the point? So it's fascinating when you look at it and spend more time in the industry and realize how it's this dance of three different components. Speaking of that, I want to ask you about one more lesson that you have in the book that really made me think that in this time, in terms of investing, you thought about your personal individual approach much more than watching other people. You say how you don't want to be distracted by what other people are doing. And tell me more about that because it's kind of introspective in the sense that you discovered what really works for you and you hinted on it throughout this conversation. But then you are able to develop this wall around you in a way where you're trying not to be influenced by what everybody else is doing.
So, Bogumil, competing with yourself makes you better. Competing with others makes you bitter.
I
Basically,
like
this is what the
that.
big learning is for me over the years, that life and investing are single player games. Here, basically, you have to remain true to your personal investment philosophy. And this second book also talked about how the dumb act of comparison with others, peers, and colleagues in the industry literally destroyed our portfolios in 2018 and 19, because in the bull market of 2014 to 17 in India, when many investors and many of our peers were buying junk quality stocks, bad quality stocks with bad owners and bad quality managements, and even those stocks were going up rapidly, because we were in a race to catch up with our peers, we basically went down the quality curve and eventually got decimated in the bear market. Because in a bear market, which are the categories of stocks which fall the hardest? It is stocks with questionable corporate governance. It is stocks of businesses with negative operating cash flow. It is stocks of businesses which are loss-making. And fourth, it is stocks of businesses which are highly indebted with a very high debt. In investing, knowing what not to do is far more important than knowing what to do. And life is just too peaceful when you're invested and so calm when you're invested in high quality businesses. What can be
Sure.
better? You basically sit back, relax, and let value compound over time. What can be better than that? So one of the best hacks in the investing field is to be happy doing nothing. But it is much more tougher than it seems on the face of it, because most people feel the need to do something because they want to show to their clients that they are doing something. That's the result. Many fund managers end up churning their portfolio a lot, keep switching between stocks now and then, and as a result, only the brokers become rich and the clients become poor as a result.
I think we started with the idea that crisis teaches us things. And I think this is a big lesson to pay attention to what works for you. Don't pay attention to what others are doing. And I brought it up before in other conversations how watching other people get richer faster than you has probably lost more money for people than anything else. I think JP Morgan had the original banker 100 years ago had a great quote about it, how watching your neighbors get rich, it's a big test. And there will be things that work briefly for a lot of people, and they can get you in trouble if you follow them. I have one last humbling thought from your book that I really wrote down and paused and thought about. He says, you share how no matter how much research and diligence you put into your stock selection efforts, you will still be wrong plenty of times in your investing journey. It's a very powerful statement coming from you. You know, you've done so much research, so much reading, and I totally agree with what you're sharing, but it's still a very honest, you know, account of what investing is all about. You can do all the work and you might be still wrong. Tell me more about that.
Like I mentioned in the beginning of this interaction, investing is a probabilistic activity. Michael Morbison has talked about this aspect for a long period of time, that it's all about shades of gray. It's never black or white. Investing is never deterministic. But people who grab the headlines on TV channels and social media are the ones who make deterministic statements that by end of this year, the market will be at this particular round number figure. The S&P 500 will hit 5,500, the round, nice sounding round number figure by the end of the year, or that we will have a big recession, or a stock market will fall by 30% this year, or that a recession is coming in the next 1 month. So the more precise and deterministic you are, the more you grab headlines. But that is not how wise, mature individuals think. Wise individuals always think in terms of probabilities, because right. The future is never certain. It is simply a branch of, branch of probability streams. So account for uncertainty and always account for your plan not going according to plan. That's the best way to plan, basically. You know, always have this buffer, this margin of safety, built in this redundancy in your life and an investing portfolio that, you know, even in the worst case scenario, you will not be wiped out. You know, many people, because they resort to leverage, derivatives, shorting, or trying to make quick money, that is the way to the poorhouse. That's the quickest way to become poor. So in investing, ironically, the more patient you are and the more long term you think, and if you're not in a hurry, that is one of the most proven ways to become wealthy over time. But generally what leads to the downfall of most investors is this desire to get rich quickly. So this get rich quick schemes keep on popping up during every bull market. They vanish in a bear market again. And then again, they start popping up in the next bull market. And people keep falling for these Ponzi schemes again and again. Because human nature in the market has not really changed much. Yeah.
No, the nature has not changed. Buffett had this quote, how people ask them how to get rich. And they say, we want to get rich as you have. Just want to do it faster. and in investing, getting places faster can get you in real trouble. I like this idea, and I share it quite often, how I want to be the least wrong. And a lot of people come to investing because they want to be right. And I think it's a very dangerous territory, and it has proven to be, at least in my mind. If you flip it on its head and you try to figure out, there's so much I don't know, there's so much that I think I know but might be different, and there's so much more that can change as my investment is in the portfolio. So I think it's a very humbling thought to think, how can I be the least wrong? And here I would add, so that I can continue to be in this game. Because any scenario for me that could lead to a total wipeout, and I don't mean, you know, even 100%, I think an 80, 90% correction in your portfolio, it's too brutal to recover in a reasonable way. I mean, I know people have done it, but... So when you think about it, whatever choices you make, and you talk a lot about quality, if you have a portfolio of quality stocks that you paid a thoughtful price for, you know, I don't know if you're going to get them all at a huge discount, then it's a nice way to participate in the success of those businesses without experiencing too much of a headache as you go. It's easy to explain, it's easy to write about, but I notice how hard it is, and it's especially hard in the times that followed the crisis, which is the bull markets that we had soon after the COVID correction and so on. I think these markets cost investors more money than the crisis itself. I think that's the unspoken truth. I saw a study, and I'm not going to name names, but there was a certain investor that got a lot of attention investing through funds in some of the high-flying stocks, and somebody did the math how much capital was lost in her funds. And the number was staggering because most of the capital went into those funds at the peak and didn't enjoy the ride all the way to the bottom. So when you think about it, these are the things I would love to avoid. That's the big lesson for me. Gautam, this was incredible. A wonderful conversation. I always have fun talking to you. And I'm so grateful that you decided to share your personal journal from a time that was not easy for any of us. And it's that idea of learning in public, sharing, and growing from here, you know, becoming better investors. And it's a journey. It's not a destination. And I'm sure there will be more ups and downs for both of us in the coming decades. And the goal is to learn from each of them and stay in the game.
Absolutely, Bogomil. The key is to keep learning and enjoy the process of learning and growth. That's basically the journey of a true value investor, a life committed to learning and personal growth.
I love that. Gautam, thank you so much for today.
Thank you so much, Bogomil.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes, and so are the opinions of the host, an employee and partner of a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on the firm is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available on advisorinfo.sec.gov.